Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Nikki Jabor, a garden writer and author of The Year-Round Vegetable Gardener, who lives and gardens in Nova Scotia, Canada. I've been aware of Nikki and her work for some time, having read her book after my wife checked it out of the library. My wife liked it so much that I wound up buying her a copy as a gift, and I, in turn, find more to like about Nikki's book every time I sit down and use it as a reference for my own garden planning. In our conversation together, Nikki and I talk about her book, the writing process and working with her publisher, gardening in a cold climate year-round, and the way we can use our ability to build or modify our environment through the use of things such as cold frames or the recycling of materials into cloches to extend the season. She also shares some of her successes, failures, and ongoing experiments before closing out with her encouragement for each of us to get out there and garden. And we also take a few minutes at the end to get a brief overview of her next book on garden designs. As you'll hear, we had a good time talking together and covered a lot of ground, including many different books, websites, and sources for more information. I can't guarantee I caught all of them, but I've included the ones I did in the resource links in the show notes. There's quite a few more there than usual. If you find this interview or any of the others in the archive valuable, please consider making a donation to the show. Through one-time or small recurring micro-donations, you help me to continue to produce these interviews and other topical podcasts. Find out how you can help by going to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. After the interview, I'll join you again with a mini review of the book, how you can enter in a drawing to receive a free copy from the publisher, and some updates. Now then, on to Nikki Jabor.
All right, then, if you're ready, could you give us your background and how it is that you came to be a garden author?
Wow, that's a long story. How long do we have? I came to gardening as a little child, really. We always had a very pathetic little vegetable garden that produced a heck of a lot of weeds and occasionally some actual edible food. But I learned early on, probably when I was about 8, that, you know, the food that you grow tastes so much better than what you buy at the grocery store. And it kind of got me interested in gardening itself. And so I started to, you know, kind of take over the garden by the time I was 10 or 12 and plan the garden. And so obviously when I grew up and had my own house, first thing I did was, where's the garden going to go? Because that's very important. Does it have a lot of sun in the house? What is it south facing? I found a great spot for the garden. You know, it's a beautiful, just a slight slope, south facing. And started to break ground on that. And at that point, I already had started writing for newspapers. I had studied horticulture, so I have a degree, as well as a degree in medieval history, another little passion of mine. And I started to write for a local newspaper every week or so. Eventually, you know, started writing for magazines, different articles on just a whole bunch of different topics. I began to lecture widely at garden clubs and different events here and there. And I was talking with the publisher, Story Publishing, and the editor of Acquisitions, Carlene Madigan, and she had put out this wonderful book called The Backyard Homestead, probably around 5 years ago, and it really took off. I mean, it sold 100,000 copies in a year. It was amazing, and she was chatting with me in my radio show about it, and she said to me, you know, you're doing some interesting things. Why don't you pitch me an idea for a book? And I was like, really? Okay, and I did, and within a week, it was approved, and I started to write The Year-Round Vegetable Gardener, so it was my first book, and you know, it's sold about 40,000 copies in the past year and a bit, and you know, I'm so pleased by it, and so pleased that people have really liked it.
And I have a copy of it here in my hands. I would say that it's my wife's copy, but really, it's our copy. After my wife got it out of the library, we both liked it so much. I love Story Publishing and what they do with books. Very heavy on pictures, lots of great information and sidebars, and it's one of the best books that I found on actually gardening year-round, because you're doing this in a less than forgiving climate.
Kindly said. Yeah, it's definitely less than forgiving. I'm in Nova Scotia, Canada, which is, well, I guess I could probably get to New York City if I drove south for 8 hours, maybe 10 hours. But yeah, I'm up north, and we do tend to get a lot of snow in the winter as well as cold weather. And I mean, even now, I mean, it's mid-June. And if we had a frost warning, I wouldn't be shocked. I mean, my tomatoes have been in for, you know, over a month, at first protected, but now, even though we haven't had much sun lately and it's not feeling very spring or summer-like, I mean, it is entirely possible that we could still get a frost here. So growing year-round was just something that, you know, evolved out of my love for food. And as I grew older and learned more about gardening, I realized certain things could go a little longer than I thought they could.
And with that knowledge, is that what you use then to look at how you could modify your landscape with your code frames and other pieces in order to extend that season even longer?
Well, yeah. I mean, I did not invent this by any stretch of the imagination. A lot of this stuff is very old knowledge, you know, and it's just kind of like we're rediscovering it. In Europe, a lot of, I mean, vegetable gardening is a way of life. Most people have their own little vegetable gardens. Even if they have very little land, they're growing food and they'll use cloches, you know, or mini hoop tunnels or cold frames. So it's almost like in North America, we kind of forgot how to do that and how easy it is and how easy it is to stretch your season. Even if you don't want to go into year-round production like I do, you can easily push back spring, you know, from a May planting date to a March or February planting date. Like, it's ridiculously easy. And it doesn't even cost very much money. Often, you know, you can make your season extenders out of recycled materials. Or if you want to push, you know, fall, you know, extend your fall for a couple months, that's easy to do too. And you just have to grow the right plants at the right time and protect them with the right season extenders, the right devices. And, you know, when I started this book, I literally just made a whole bunch of notes and I had no idea what it was going to end up looking like. And, you know, try to organize my thoughts into how I would have wanted to learn the process. Because there's some great books there out there on year-round extending, but most of them were aimed at market gardeners. And I didn't have room in my urban backyard for a 30 by 100 foot greenhouse. So I wanted to try to bring this to the everyday gardener, you know, just the home gardeners with families and people who just wanted to try to grow a little more food for a longer period of time.
What have been in this process of adapting this information and getting your garden into place where you could grow year-round? What have been some of the interesting successes and failures of that process?
Oh, there's been lots, lots of all of them. One of the greatest things I love, I thought this would turn out to be a lot more work. The most work for the year-round gardening is thinking differently, I guess. Like instead of, you know, putting everything in the long weekend in May, like we did growing up, you know, now I'm planting things all the time. I've mastered succession planting as much as anybody can, I think. There's always more to learn, which is wonderful, but you know, so I'm always succession planting and often I use my grow lights throughout summer to give me a constant supply of fresh seedlings, whether it's salad greens or, you know, things like kohlrabi or more kale, things like that. So, you know, it's learning more about how to grow more food, even starting with my lights. But a great side benefit of it has been the fact that, you know, for 8 months of the year, most of my vegetables are protected, whether it's, again, a cold frame, a mini hoop tunnel, a cloche, a thick layer of mulch, for goodness sakes, and the deer can't get to them. Because we do have a lot of deer here, a lot. And, you know, when I'm growing things out of season or out of their traditional season, the deer can't reach the vegetables. There's no slugs or flea beetles, you know, bugging my arugula like it does at this time of the year. You know, when I'm picking arugula in December or January from a cold frame, there's no pests. As well, in the wintertime, there's no weeding. There's no watering. There's no fertilizing. It's literally basically from early December, late November, you know, up until February, mid, late February, when I start to add more seeds to the cold frames as the spaces get emptied. It's literally just harvesting. So the low maintenance, I think, surprised me. And I think it surprises a lot of people. And people always say to me, how can you possibly grow vegetables in wintertime? It's too cold. You live in Canada. But, you know, I'm not growing vegetables in winter. Things don't really grow when you have a limited amount of sunlight. It's just the fact that they hold in their season extenders and I can just harvest them whenever I want. It's been a huge learning curve for me, but it's been really fun. And there's definitely been some failures. The first year I had cold frames, I planted things too early so that they grew too large. And that when I would close my cold frames, all the plants, all the leafy greens were leaning up against the top of the cold frame top so that when we had warm days, they just burned. You know, the hot plastic laying on top of those tender salad greens just burned the leaves. So I had a lot of damage that way. And then when we went into winter with the greens still touching the tops, you know, they got cold damage. So timing the crops became really important, and I spent years juggling planting dates, trying to figure out, counting backwards for my frost date, how and when I should plant my seedlings. And that turned out really well, actually. And of course, all that's in the book. People could just see, when do I plant arugula? You know, you look up, you open the book, 6 weeks before the last frost date. Perfect. Depending which season extender you want to use. So hopefully I took the guesswork out of that for people, but that was a big learning curve for me too.
Well, and I do think that your planting calendars for each of the various plants that you've included are very easy to follow.
Which is total credit to my editor, actually, Carlene. She's a visionary.
In putting this together, that's one question that I had for you is, what was that writing process like, working with your editor and putting a book together and deciding what to include, what to remove? Did you start with like a 400-page tome, or it was cut down to this book, or was it more just like your notes and then trying to expand into something that would work?
As a first book, I always said to my editor, I really wish the publishers would give you a little pamphlet at least, or a little booklet saying tips when you're writing your first book on organization. Because yeah, it was definitely tricky to figure out how to do that. I knew it was going to be 256 pages, and I knew some of that would be indexes and table of contents and all that sort of stuff. So I knew I had to write, I think it was, oh my gosh, 60,000 words. Looking back, I don't even remember. Maybe it was 90,000 words. I knew it was approximate. So at first, I just wrote down the things that I thought were important. Obviously, we had to have a big section on all the plants, because those are the kind of the superstars. You know, people want to know what they can grow and when they need to be planted. But I also knew I had to write about my season extenders, you know, the cold frames and all the different things that I use. And then I wanted to also include something about succession planting and interplanting, because that just keeps your crop nonstop. And it also, you know, interplanting or vertical growing, it helps you include more food in the space you have, whether it's a big or small space. So I wanted to include that. And I also just wanted to introduce people to my garden and what I do. So I tried to break it up that way and then just write each section. There were things that got cut. I had actually written a lot more on soil enhancement and you know, amending your soils. There's a nice section on that in there, but I had written quite a bit more. So that, you know, that got cut by about half, I would say. But, you know, story, once you have your book contract, they basically say, go crazy, do what you want to do, it's your book. So, you know, I wrote what I wanted to write. And then when I was finished, I sent it to my editor. I didn't send her pieces here and there. I just sent her the whole block. And we went from there. So they helped arrange it and organize it. The one thing I think I should have done is in the season extender section, I didn't actually give a whole section to mulch. I talk about it a lot for overwintering things like carrots and parsnips and beets and even leeks and stuff. But I should have given it's such an important season extender. I should have given it its own little section like I did for cold frames and mini hoop tunnels, because I do use a lot of mulch and it's very obviously cheap and easy, an easy way to extend your season for, you know, about a dozen different types of vegetables.
Talking about mulch so much and not including it in your book, what is your favorite mulch?
I use shredded leaves or straw, mainly shredded leaves because it's free. And I do, again, I talk about it in the book. I just didn't give it its own little section. But yeah, I you know, it's one of those things. I have a lot of leaves around my property. Plus my neighbors, I could easily collect 100 bags from around my neighborhood in probably half an hour come autumn. And I just pile all those garbage bags up. I get about 40 from my own property and I use them in the pathways of my garden. I use them in the summer garden, you know, to mulch my potatoes and tomatoes and protect, help prevent diseases and things like tomato blight. But yeah, in the winter garden, you know, putting a foot thick layer of shredded leaves on a lot of my crops just really protects them and helps me harvest them all winter long.
I always look forward to when I'm coming home, driving along the road that I live on, waiting in the fall to see the bags start to pile up, because to me, leaves are just gold. And I wish that I could convince my neighbors of how valuable these are for their gardens.
It's true. And even if you don't use them yourself, like right away, even if you're not going to use them like for something right away, I use them for sheet mulching when I'm making new garden beds, whether ornamental or edible garden beds. I just pile them up beside my compost or some of the bags so that in the wintertime, when you're adding vegetable scraps to your composters, you can still add some brown materials too. Or I just literally dump a whole bunch of leaves in a huge pile, add a few shovelfuls of soil and mix them up and leave it. And, you know, within about a year, I have the most beautiful compost that I did nothing to for my gardens. I just don't know why people give them away and then go out and buy compost for their gardens.
I'm very much a slow composter. Sometimes I feel like I'm a lazy gardener for all the things that I just kind of let sit and molder somewhere.
Yeah, I do that too. Have you read the book actually by Barbara Pleasant and I think Deb Martin about the Complete Compost Gardener Guide? It's my compost Bible.
I'll have to put that down. I have one of the older copies of Rodale's Complete Book of Composting, but in there they're talking about you composting animal waste and many other things that we don't currently discuss when gardening.
No. One of my daughter's friends does have a bunny, and she, every time she comes over, she brings me Ziploc baggies of bunny poo, which I will add to my compost. But generally speaking, yeah, there's not a lot of manures, you know, at least carnivore-type manures in my compost, that's for sure.
Are you doing any kind of integrated animal composting with like vermicomposting or anything else like that?
I do, mainly because it's so much fun, you know, to build your own little worm poo stations, which is what we call them. We just, you know, we have plastic bins and, you know, some garden soil, a little bit of compost, some shredded leaves, you know, kitchen scraps, and we just keep feeding the worms. And I don't have one of those commercial worm condos that you can buy, which would be very nice to have, but you know, just plastic bins works fine too. And it's fun to watch the worms and see how they break the different organic materials down. And then we can put that worm poop in our garden. So it's it's very wonderful to watch and to see nature at work on such a close-up level.
And the worms are one of my favorites to do for demonstrations because I'm out in public and I'll have a handful of worms. I'm all covered in the worm compost and everything. And the children will run over and go, "Oh, worms!" And they'll start picking them and playing with them. And then their parents just seem a little squeamish.
It's true.
And you mentioned, though, that these are useful for fishing. And then it's like some of the dads perk up and then you start talking about other things. And it's like a couple minutes later, the entire family is just standing around the table, poking at the worms, seeing what they're like, what they can do with them. And
I mean, they're amazing. And that's one of the benefits, too, of using shredded leaves or mulch in your garden. When you put straw or shredded mulch on top of your garden beds as a mulch, the worms, it just attracts them like crazy. And I find, you know, the first year or two of our garden, we had a few worms. You know, but, you know, so many years on now, when I dig a hole or, you know, or anything, when I put my hands in the soil, it's worm laden. It's wonderful. And it's such a good, I guess, indicator of a soil health. So I love seeing the worms out there.
As you've improved the soil where you're living and been doing all this composting and mulching and building fertility, have you noticed a change in the mushrooms in your soil?
I do. And I do try to not disturb my soil too much. You know, I wouldn't call myself a no-dig gardener because that it's innate. It's almost inborn in you to want to work the soil in spring, you know, or especially as you add compost and manures and things like that. And, you know, I try to put the stuff on top and let the earthworms do their work. And then when I'm planting, I just dig a hole for that plant. And I try not to disturb the soil. And I do notice, you know, more fungi growth, you know, and it's so interesting. As you leave the soil alone to notice the changes in it, and the plants really do seem to do better. So, you know, I do a lot of reading on that topic, but, you know, I think when you're out there practicing it yourself and can see the changes, it just kind of makes more an impact on you and on your gardening techniques.
As you've developed your methods of gardening in a colder climate, what techniques have you developed that have made this process easier on you, not just for extending the season, but some things that people might not think about in a cold climate as a gardener?
I don't know if this is related to the cold climate, but one thing I did when I started extending my season is I realized my garden design was not effective. So, you know, I tell people if they want to start extending their season and they want to put a new garden in, to think about season extending before they put the new garden in. So, for example, all my beds, at one point I had these lovely, tidy 4x4 foot squares. And you know what? For a mini hoop tunnel, it's not easy to make one in 4x4 foot squares. So my garden beds are all generally 4 feet by 10 feet now. Perfect size for a mini hoop tunnel. So I've kind of changed my design the more I've gone on and learned more about, you know, gardening year round and extending my season. My cold frames are sunk into the earth. I was thinking that because I do live in a colder climate, if I sink my cold frames down into the earth and I use, you know, 2-inch wide hemlock boards, untreated local wood, very rot resistant, and very inexpensive. And because they're so rough, the hemlock, the slugs don't like to climb on them either. So another little benefit to hemlock. But I sunk my cold frames into the earth thinking that'll, you know, insulate my crops better. And, you know, one of my neighbors down the road put a cold frame in using 1-inch wide wood, just pine untreated, raised his cold frames about 2 feet above the earth. And his plants do just as well as mine. You know, we've been looking at it for years now. And even though mine are thicker wood, sunk into the earth, you know, we grow the same things and they both basically come out the same. So, you know, it's always a learning process, I think, you know, as maybe his spot is slightly more sheltered than mine and that makes for the difference. But I've tried to take, you know, my northern climate into account as I garden. And of course, the defining factor of success with a year-round garden is the sunlight you get. So even in winter when you don't have a lot of sunlight, I still want my cold frames to be facing south, or south, I guess you pronounce it, so that they're getting all the winter sunlight that my cold frames can still take that solar energy in. And, you know, the plants can defrost so that I can still harvest midday, you know, through supper time. You know, so there's lots of little things to take into account, no matter where you live. And you do have to take into account when your day length slips below that lovely magical 10-hour time limit. And for me here, it's about November 3rd or 4th every year. So I have to make sure that my plants in the cold frames are the size they should be by the time early November rolls around, or else, you know, I'm going to have these tiny little plants in my cold frames that are going to be too small really to harvest from all winter. So you have to find out wherever you are in the world when your day length slips below that 10-hour time limit. And that'll kind of be your point of reference for counting backwards when you're wanting to know when to plant this or when to plant that sort of thing.
And do you have a resource where people could find that information?
Well, the book is where I kind of packed everything. I do have a blog, of course, which people can find if they go to my website, nikkijabor.com. And, you know, that's the blog, which has become sorely neglected. And over the past few years, I do update it with what I'm doing in the garden, though, and people can see some of my experiments. Like, for example, this year, one of the things, a couple of things I'm growing are I'm growing quinoa in the garden and amaranth. Last year, I grew cotton. You know, I'm also growing chickpeas again this year. I got a really interesting heirloom black chickpea from Afghanistan, which I'm trying to grow this year. And they're doing really well, even with the complete lack of sunlight and heat. So you just never know, I guess.
I think I may need to contact you later to see how those black chickpeas work out and see if those can be shipped from Canada to the U.S. to try.
We just won't tell anybody. I'll just stick them in the mail. Shh.
The quinoa and amaranth are interesting to me because I've wanted to grow some in order to make I'm on a gluten-free diet, a medically necessary one, which my listeners know about. And because of that, I've wanted to do some gluten-free beers with that.
It's funny. My next book, which will be coming out in December, Groundbreaking Food Gardens, there's a garden design in there from one of Canada's top brewmasters, Rebecca Kinnean, out in British Columbia. And she designed a brewmaster garden, actually. So a garden with lots of vegetables, brewing herbs, fruits that can be used in the brewing process, and of course the hops and so many other really unique things. You just make me think that, of course, a food garden doesn't just have to be about vegetables. It can be about things like beer making.
And that's one of the things about our conversations within the permaculture community is about making sure that we meet our needs, whether those are food, fiber, or fuel. And as you and I were talking before we began the interview, and as you have been talking about designing a garden, for me, this year I'm looking at trying to build some habitat to get my deer to go to so that they don't, you know, browse my willow to the ground or eat my fennel.
Exactly. I think when you design a garden, you have to take Mother Nature into account and all the creatures that are going to visit your garden. You know, I do find deer particularly frustrating, and I've been threatening for years to go electric around the vegetable garden, but alas, I think I'm going to stick with the deer netting and give it one more shot. I have 8-foot-tall deer netting, and I've seen them jump it from a standstill, but I'm going to try to go another a little bit higher this year, maybe put some bright colored rope around the very top and keep my fingers crossed.
Something that was recommended to me was that, I don't know if this is true or not, I haven't done a lot of research on it, but that deer's depth of field for their vision is not very good. And that with your deer netting, if you put a shorter fence, like 2 or 3 feet on the outside of that, which could just be like a string going around, that can be enough sometimes to deter because they don't know whether or not they can make both the depth and the height. I don't know if that's true. I haven't gotten to experiment with it much where I am, but
it is actually. One of the gardeners I know, and she actually did this design for my next book too. It's a keeping the critters out type garden, and it's 2 5-foot deer fences, you know, spaced about 5 feet apart. So it's not these huge, crazy barrier fences that block sunlight. The 2 very beautiful 5-foot fences, which she's then using to, you know, grow different fruit trees and vines and food crops. But the deer, if they can't think that they can, you know, if they don't think they can make the jump, then they won't. I just don't have the space for 2 fences like that. But I might try your couple feet out, go put some string around the garden too, a second layer. Maybe that'll help.
I hope so.
I do too.
I know how destructive that they can be. And here where I am, as hunting kind of has stabilized and in some areas is in decline, but the deer population continues to go up. I just see more and more, and they've cost us quite a few vehicle repairs in the last few years.
Yeah, they're pretty bad. And I think we have similar climates, really, because you're in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I mean, that's so beautiful. I was just outside Pittsburgh last year for the Mother Earth News Fair talking about year-end vegetable gardening, actually. And the amount of people that come to that fair, you know, with an interest in permaculture and growing food and just being more responsible gardeners, it was so inspiring to me.
Does that help keep you going as a writer to hear back from your listeners and to go to those kinds of events and get the feedback that what you're doing is positive for them?
It is, because, I mean, generally speaking, I work from home. So you're sitting in your home office, staring at your garden, thinking, I should be out there. Writing, and you know, oftentimes it's a very solitary sort of thing, and obviously things like Facebook and Twitter and all the different, you know, online social media have kind of taken the isolation down a little bit. But yeah, you're writing sometimes, and you're writing hoping what you're sharing is going to be interesting to people and that they're going to like them. And I mean year-end vegetable gardener, I had no idea if anybody would even care about, you know, what I do in the garden and these, you know, the season extending that I do. And the amount of letters and emails and Facebook messages and tweets and stuff that I get from people, it's been overwhelming. It's been incredible. So there's a lot of people out there that really want to grow food and really want to know how to do it for a longer period of time.
And that you're doing it and that you are, in a way, you're practicing what you preach. And I think that makes a difference.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't write about what I didn't know. You know, I think that's the basic rule of writing. Write about what you know. And that is what I have done. I like to write about sometimes things that you want to know more about, too, so that I can then go out and experiment in the garden and learn more. And then as you become better at it, then you can write about that, too, and share your experiences. You know, yeah, it's one of those things. You should definitely write about what you know. And you should also, like, in the book, too, I do share a lot of my disasters because not everything is successful. Like, I certainly try every year a lot of new plants to see what I can grow throughout the winter. And some things do really, really well, and some things do not. They turn to mush. So, you know, I try to share that in the book so that people can have maybe less failures than I did.
A recurring theme with many of my guests is the idea that wisdom is learning from someone else's mistakes. And that's why I think that these stories are so important, because we've all had these kinds of failures, and it provides a certain level of honesty for people to hear that and to know.
You know, I've written articles. Some of my most popular newspaper columns have been my garden blunders. You know, the things that I've screwed up over the years, because people want to know that everybody does that. And that's how we learn. Oh my goodness. There was one year, I had a small garden and I bought like 3 packs of nasturtiums because I love them. And I didn't realize they were vining nasturtiums. And I planted every seed in those 3 packs in this 8x10 foot garden, just thinking it would, you know, add color to the vegetables. There were no vegetables left by the time those nasturtiums got through with that garden. And when we pulled them all out in late summer, it was a pile of nasturtium vines higher than me. And I'm about 5'4". So live and learn, right?
Yes. And were those an edible nasturtium?
Yes. Thank goodness. But there's only so many nasturtium leaves you want to eat.
They're one of my favorite garden snacks, and my wife makes sure that she plants them near things that I should be tending more regularly.
She sounds like a genius.
She is. I do a lot of the heavy lifting in our garden, and she does a lot of the planting. So.
Yes, well, that's often how it goes, and the same in our garden as well. And it's awfully nice to have someone to work in the garden. It just makes it more enjoyable, and especially with kids too, like planting. And my kids take a point of pride in the cold frames. You know, when they have play dates in the middle of winter, you know, before they even come inside the house after the school bus, they'll run up to the cold frames. And what color carrot do you want? Do you want a purple one? Do you want yellow? You can get any color you want, you know, and it's almost like showing off. Or do you want a kale popsicle? That's what they call the big frozen kale leaves, kale popsicles. And I'll pop one off and just kind of chew on it. And it's amazing. I almost wouldn't believe it if I didn't see it myself.
And having children in the garden is one of my most enjoyable moments. Well, as you say, you started gardening at a young age, and having that experience really, I think, does make a difference.
Does. Yeah. And I mean, the kids also make me look closer at the garden. You know, sometimes when you're working, you forget to see, oh, what is that hum? Oh, that's the bees. Look at all the bees in the chamomile, or, you know, in the kale flowers, or, you know, oh, there's a toad. Let's chase the toad. He's going to eat the slugs for us. So you kind of forget to just stop and look, and you see the most incredible things. Well, last year, for example, we had the most incredible ladybug factory in our mint patch with adults and larvae, you know, which looked like the most cool little interesting little alligator type shaped bugs. And then there were eggs. So, you know, we would take the ladybugs, the adults and some of the larvae, and take them in the backyard to our sunflowers in the vegetable garden and put them on there because there were aphids. And of course, ants also come along with the aphids. Sometimes they're guarding the aphids, milking them like cows for that lovely sweet nectar. And so we would put the aphids or the ladybugs and the larvae on the sunflowers. And then the ants would come by and pick up an adult ladybug, carry it to the end of the leaf and toss it right off. It was the most interesting, crazy display of just raw nature. And we just, for weeks, that would be our outdoor entertainment. Let's go check on the sunflowers, see how the ladybugs are doing with the aphids and the ants. It's nature at its most, I don't know, basic, most primitive. It was incredible.
Another side of the work that I do is as an environmental educator. And I'm just wondering, do you find the garden to be a classroom for you and your children?
For sure. I mean, sometimes the older they get, the less interested they are in actually, you know, being out there, but they enjoy the food that comes from the garden, but sometimes they don't really want to take part anymore in planning it. But I also have a lot of nieces and nephews and really young ones as well. And so there's just a constant parade of kids that like to come up to the garden. And when kids come over for play dates, I mean, that's the first place they go, the garden. And it's not just because they want to pull food to eat something like a carrot, but it's just because it's so pretty. And, you know, there's flowers and there's herbs and there's beautiful vegetables. And I also grow things that I think, you know, really pique the interest of the kids too, like snake gourds that get longer than us, or long dipper gourds, or, you know, just really different things. They'll grow, you know, heirloom white corn. or just things that will interest them as well as, you know, interesting us. And if you can engage them in the garden, and, you know, my children know what a broccoli plant looks like in the garden, but my older sister had no idea when she came in the garden a couple of years ago. She's like, is that broccoli? And my kids are like, yeah, that's how broccoli grows. So once you introduce them, like, that is how food is grown, I think they're going to hopefully take more responsibility for their own food in the future.
Is that experimentation part of the fun for you as a gardener, growing all these different things?
I think absolutely. I'm always worried that, you know, I'm going to get tired of it. You know, I think it's one of those things, you know, when I first started being interested in gardening too, I loved the herbs. And then I moved to annual flowers. And then I wanted to do perennials. And then I really realized that it's the edible plants that really are my passion. And it's one of those things I always think, when the seed catalogs come, am I still going to be excited? Because once you get so immersed in it as a career, it's like, am I still going to care what the new lettuces are, or some heirloom lettuces or different heirloom tomatoes this year? But I do. And, you know, planting the seeds under my grow lights in the spring, you know, wondering what we're going to grow this year. We all grab seed catalogs and circle the different things we want to try. You know, we save seeds. Sometimes, you know, we play in the garden trying to cross-pollinate zinnias or, you know, cucumbers or something, just to see what we're going to end up with. And, you know, it definitely keeps the garden exciting for us. And trying new things is always nice, because I know I'm not going to grow enough quinoa this year to keep us in quinoa all winter long next, you know, but hopefully we'll grow enough that we can have a few feeds of quinoa. And the plants are very beautiful and ornamental. You can even eat the leaves of them. So, you know, just to introduce the kids and myself to the cultivation of quinoa is really exciting.
With the garden and the variety of things that you're growing, how much space do you have available that you're using?
I don't know a lot of gardeners that say, oh my gosh, I have so much space. Just like, I don't know anybody that produces enough compost. You can never have enough. I have 2,000 square feet of space. So I'm sure I should say that that is enough, but it is not. And out there now, I've still got trays of things that I've started indoors waiting to go in the garden. And I'm thinking, where am I going to put these? I need more space. And some spots of the garden are a little more shaded than others. So the bits that are a little more shaded tend to get the salad greens and, you know, things that don't mind a little bit of shade. And the really beautiful hot spots I save for the tomatoes and the eggplants and the peppers and the things that really appreciate the heat, like the chickpeas. Not that we've had any heat to speak of as of yet, but fingers crossed. But yeah, it's just so much fun to grow different things and experiment all the time.
Is that 2,000 square feet all the property that you have to grow in, or just the best property that you have to grow in?
It's all I'm allowed. The front of our property is the kids' sledding hill. And we do actually have a lovely 40-foot by 100-foot south-facing flat piece of land in the back right beside my vegetable gardens. So technically speaking, that's 4,000 more square feet I could grow in. And, you know, but that is also our, you know, place where we play badminton and soccer. And, you know, that's where we roll around in the grass and you know, we play outdoor movies for ourselves and our friends in the summertime. So I'm surrounding it with high bush blueberries and hasscap berries and apple trees and cherry trees. And I'm adding clover to the lawn to make it softer and for bee forage and for lots of different things. So I'm slowly surrounding it with edible plants. And there'll come a point when maybe I'll start to encroach upon it a little bit more.
Slowly chip away until you have that 2,500 feet, 3,000 feet, then it's all yours.
Exactly. I could use a lot more space. I myself, you know, I tend to really like to experiment with my favorite things. And I love to grow the heirloom tomatoes, but I love beans. You know, beans are the first crop I ever realized tasted better when you grew them yourself. And so I'm always growing varieties of pole beans and bush beans and heirloom varieties and just trying different beans, because it's one of my favorite things to grow too.
Doing gardening year round and having 2,000 square feet devoted to your gardening space, if I understand right, you have 4 people in your family?
Yep.
What percentage of your diet would you say comes out of your garden?
Not enough, really, because I'm thinking we should be even doing even more. But, you know, in the summertime and spring and autumn, I would say 75-80% of our vegetables come from our garden. But in the wintertime, you know, it's probably more like half. I do grow a lot of carrots. I grow a lot of kale in the wintertime. Leeks, my gosh, I love it. And we store things like garlic and onions, nonstop parade of salad greens, as well as things like, my gosh, parsnips and beets. So we do grow quite a bit. But if I had more space, I think I need to put in, I only have 4 cold frames right now. So I need to probably, you know, double or triple my cold frames. Or, you know, I'd need to get a little hoop house, an actual walk-in structure where I could perhaps grow more food as well. I don't have a polytunnel right now, but that would definitely increase my production. Maybe if I take over some of that. grasslands. I could put a little growing structure there as well. But it certainly does cut our grocery bills significantly. Because if I go to the grocery store here in Nova Scotia, all of the salads are in, you know, $5 little plastic containers. And all of the different types of greens come from California. California is awfully far away from Nova Scotia. I have no trouble growing arugula, lettuce, pak choy, spinach, Swiss chard, tatsoi, mizuna, you know, so many different things all winter long here. Thankfully, a lot of our local farmers are now having polytunnels and starting to produce more salads. So if I go to the farmer's market in winter, as an average person who doesn't have a winter garden, you can get more of these things, but it's just starting really. So I'm hoping that more people will be able to buy a lot more local food in the wintertime. I certainly, you know, I'm trying to increase my production even more. But again, when you're living in an urban space, you only have so much, really so much room to grow in sometimes.
When it comes to planning your garden, now that you've been doing this for a while and doing the succession planning, are you finding that this is getting easier and taking less time?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I generally know what I want to grow, and I know how long it takes to grow. I like to grow most of my salads as baby crops, generally, just because I love picking all those tender leaves, and I love to go up to the garden with a bowl and just pick a little of this and a little of that to make this beautiful mixed salad, for example. So, yeah, it's definitely quicker for me. And again, putting my grow lights to work, even at this time of the year, again, it makes succession planting so simple. I just plug things in when things come out. And when it comes to establishing crops, I find that's a big challenge for people, especially in slightly warmer climates. With all these dry, hot summers we've been getting, these droughts, it's hard to get lettuce to grow in late August, early September, when you need to start establishing it, you know, for a winter crop. So using my grow lights and starting things indoors, and then I can just plug them into the garden when I need them for fall crops and winter crops, it makes it so much easier. Because lettuce is not going to germinate, you know, once the soil temperature is really over about 80. So if you want to grow lettuce or a bunch of other different cold season salad greens, you're going to have to start them yourself inside and plug them in, or over your garden bed, provide some sort of shading, like a shade cloth draped over top of the garden bed, so that you can, you know, give the seeds a chance to grow even in the heat of summer.
And I just taking a look in the book to check out your grow lights, and it looks like you're using daylight fluorescence.
Yeah. I mean, I've used lots of different types of lights, plant lights, aquarium lights, just fluorescent lights, cool, warm. But they work fine. The key, of course, when you're using grow lights, and I did not do this for the first 2 or 3 years, and my plants were very stretched, is to make sure I have them on chains so that I always make sure they're only about 3 inches, no further than 3 inches above my plants as they grow. Because the higher up you go, you're losing all those foot candles. So make sure you keep your lights low and right over your plants. And as the plants grow, just move them up on chains. Or if you have actual grow lights you buy, they have nice legs and supports. You just turn the knobs in the side and they move up.
I was using grow lights on chains as well. And one thing that we also ran into is if your grow light system is somewhere near a window, we found a lot of our plants were escaping around the grow lights.
And that's true. Mine are in the basement where it's pitch dark. They get no natural light at all. And I do actually have one of the walls I painted white so that it would reflect light back to the plants again too. But, you know, grow light systems, very inexpensive. I just get shop lights and I make my own reflectors, even from tinfoil. You don't have to go out and spend $140 or $50 on, you know, a 4-foot grow light. It's ridiculous.
And it really sounds like you're a fan of recycling, reusing, repurposing, and generally trying to keep the price of all these things low.
Big time, because I'm a gardener and I'm thrifty. You know, I think gardeners don't want to spend more money than they have to. And if we're going to spend money, it's usually on seeds or plants or really good tools. You know, I like my tools to last a long time, so I have a couple of really good tools that I love that have done me well for well over a decade. So sometimes, you know, I would put a little money in a good tool for sure. I do like to save money. Often a lot of my cloches are simply milk jugs or pop bottles, you know, or big juice containers. And I just take the bottom off them. You keep the little screw on lid so that if it's cold, you can screw it up top. And if it's hot out, you can just, you know, or if it's warm, you can just unscrew the top so they can vent themselves. My mini hoop tunnels, you know, made from recycled materials. You know, my cold frames are made from local inexpensive woods. Yeah, so I try to keep the cost down, really. I don't think I should be paying more than I would if I'm buying the food, if I'm growing the food myself. I definitely want it to be as inexpensive as possible. And here in Canada, too, we actually have to garden organically. We have pesticide bylaws here, so you can't spray chemicals or weed killers and stuff on your lawns or on your garden. So it's the only way to go anyway, but growing organically is something we all do here.
Do you have a few minutes? Could you expand on that? That's something I've never heard of or am familiar with.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if I went out, you can't buy weed and feed here for your lawn. But if I could and I put it on my lawn, I would be in trouble. You're not allowed to do that here, and you haven't for about a decade. I mean, there are some pesticides you can use that, like safer soap you can use. You can use BT, an organic bacteria. There's certain organic or natural items you can use, like sulfur, to control different fungal problems and things like that. But generally speaking, you cannot go out and buy a chemical to kill the chinch bugs in your lawn or to kill, you know, whatever's on your flowers, red lily beetle or slugs. You can't use any chemicals. You have to do it naturally. Even dandelions and stuff like that, you have to, you know, there's lots of ways to do it naturally, and that's promoted here, and you're not allowed. You can't even actually go out and buy these things anymore. For the first few years after the pesticide ban went into effect, you could still buy weed and feed. You weren't supposed to apply it, but you could still buy it. But now everything is off the shelves, so you can't buy it anymore here.
So that's pesticides, herbicides, and a broad range of what we might consider normal garden chemicals?
Normal garden chemicals. Things like Roundup, like Killex, gone. Not allowed. Can't use them. It's lovely. So when your children are playing in the park, you know there's no Killex on that lawn. And we do obviously get a few more weeds in our lawns now, but one thing we've learned is that that's okay. It's acceptance. And more people are planting clover in their lawn, low-growing white Dutch clover, which turns just as green. It doesn't actually get dried up in the middle of the summer like grass can when it goes dormant. The clover stays green all the time. It attracts the bees, you know, the beneficial insects, provides forage for the deer as well. We up here have to be natural gardeners.
That's so interesting. Now I'll have to do some more research on that, include some links in the show notes for people to find out more about that.
Yeah, there's lots of links. I can send you some as well. There's actually something that started in Quebec, our French province here in Canada. It started there probably 15 or more years ago now, and it's just slowly spread across Canada. Not every province is completely organic, but it's happening. And, you know, our city, Halifax, is organic. I mean, we don't throw anything out. I haven't thrown, like, I mean, for 20 years, you don't throw glass bottles or pop containers or anything like that. It's all recycled. Even our kitchen scraps, you don't, you know, once you finish dinner, it's been 15 years since you throw that in the garbage. That all goes in a green bin, which gets collected every week by the city, turned into free compost that you can then go and get.
Are there any restrictions on what you can put into that, or does the city handle all that processing?
There are restrictions of what you can put in, yes. But they're not major restrictions. Mainly you put your food products in, garden waste, you know, weeds, things like that that I don't want in my own compost. But you can't put in things like dryer lint or things like that. But, you know, there's a chart. There's a chart you can very easily follow. I mean, at first people were like, oh, this is too much work. But, you know, within a couple months, everybody has embraced it. And, you know, I have not heard a complaint in well over a decade. It's just something that people have accepted, that they are recycling their glass, their plastics, you know, and we recycle a wide variety of plastics as well, so that the amount of garbage you have every week is very little.
For your green bins, can you also put in things like meat or dairy or fats, or are those excluded?
Nope, you're allowed to put those in because it's the compost piles are so large, you know, where they're done by the city, that they're very hot composted, and those types of things can be broken down.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I wouldn't put it in my own composter. You know, I reserve that for fruit, vegetable scraps, garden waste, you know, the typical things. But in the city compost, yeah, definitely all that goes in there. And it feels very strange, you know, when you go places to cities that don't do that. And you're like, where do you put this glass bottle? And it goes in the garbage. Or, you know, your food scraps just go in the garbage. It feels very strange.
My wife and I have gotten to the point that we carry a bag with us if we're traveling somewhere so we can take all those things with us. And we've caught ourselves collecting. Going to like a family picnic, as the family starts to collect the bottles and things, we'll wind up putting them in the bag. No, we can take these home and recycle them.
I do that when we go to, like, you go to my sister's house or something, you're having a big corn boil. I take all of those corn husks home with me for my own compost. Or, you know, you go to your local Starbucks or your local coffee shop, and they've got baskets with their used coffee grounds for the gardener. So you just go in there and you take the coffee grounds, and I bring them home and I put them in my composter, or I use them in sheet mulching as a nitrogen source. Yeah, we recycle absolutely everything we possibly can.
Around here, regretfully, our farmers have found out that Starbucks gives away their grounds, so there's no longer go out to the public. I have to call ahead and ask them to put some aside if I know I'm going to be going by.
Well, it's nice that they will. So useful in composting.
Thank you so much for this conversation, Nikki. You know, as I fawn a little, I love the book. I think it's a great book for gardeners. For permaculture practitioners, I think it's really great for that Zone 1 and Zone 2 gardening. for those places that are close to home, that front door to car door kind of space.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that. It was fun to write, and I'm just so glad that so many people have enjoyed it, you know, and taken up year-round gardening. I get so many pictures from people of their gardens. I love it. Love it.
And after trying so many different gardening systems for those close spaces that my wife and I have gone through, it's just we find that the way that you relay information and about building fertility and growing your garden over time really makes it easy to be a gardener.
Oh, thanks. That sounds great to hear. Yeah, feed your soil and it'll feed you back. I mean, it's an old wisdom, really, I think, by gardeners from centuries ago, but it's true. I'm just passing that along, hopefully to a new generation of people that will try new things in their garden. I mean, no matter what, try different things, try new crops, experiment with new flavors and have fun. I mean, obviously, we're trying to grow more food in a responsible way, but have fun with it as well.
And I love that thought as a note to end on, but is there anything else that you'd like to add to this interview for the listeners?
Gosh, well, I hope that they will get out and enjoy themselves in the garden. You know, a lot of people ask a lot about, you know, how to incorporate more food into their gardens and just, you know, with succession planting and interplanting and adding fruits and everything. And, you know, that is what my next book will be about, groundbreaking food gardens. It was awesome. I stalked about 72 experts from around the world, whether it's a home gardener, a garden writer, you know, somebody who does this professionally, some of the different public gardens throughout America and Canada. And I bugged them on and off for about a year until they gave me a design for an edible garden. And then I interviewed them and wrote up their garden and the details and the plants included. And Story is putting that book together now, and it should be coming out in December. So I'll have 73 plans in all, including one from me, on different designs for edible spaces, for fruits, vegetables, herbs, edible flowers, anything. It was so exciting.
Well, I certainly look forward to that. Just the thought of that homebrewer's garden. Are there any other gardens with that kind of a specialization that you'd like to just mention before we bring this to a close?
There was a lot of really interesting gardens in the book. Amy Stewart has a wonderful new book that came out this year called The Drunken Botanist, and she gave me a garden designed for a cocktail-themed garden. You know, there's a wonderful blogger in the UK who blogs about salad every day of the year, and so Michelle Chapman, and she gave me a design for a very small 4x8-foot garden, but this garden, she has succession planted it through four seasons so that there's always something to harvest from it. An edible hedge, you know, of all these different native and imported fruit crops. You know, just so many really interesting designs. A circle of life garden that includes chickens, too, as an odor circle in this beautiful series of rings in this garden. A pallet garden from Joe Lample, the host of Growing a Greener World. Foraging gardens. I mean, I was really inspired. The problem is, of course, now I'm looking at my garden going, how can I make it better? After seeing all these incredible designs, I'm very inspired. And now I want to change. But that would require a lot of work. So I'm not sure.
It's easy sometimes, I think, to look at the designs of others and go, oh, if I had done that. And then I look at my own garden and go, no, I have the time and energy invested into this one. I can change it a little and enjoy what it is.
That's so true. And that's good wisdom as well. I think we should always strive to improve our gardens and such. But, you know, embrace what you've already got as well. Because, I mean, it's just so much fun to be out there playing in the garden. And even though it's pouring right now, I think I'm going to put my big old galoshes on in a few minutes and head up to the garden and check out to make sure the deer haven't gotten in there and see how things are doing.
Well, you have a wonderful rest of your day. I think I'll wind up working on my tan later as well as I go and get the grass out of my strawberries.
Sounds wonderful. Thank you so much, Scott.
Thank you, Nikki. Take care.
You too.
And that was Nikki Jabor. As I mentioned while talking with Nikki, I find her book invaluable for permaculture practitioners, especially those working in a cold climate, when planning zones 1 and 2. The clarity of information and the many useful hints and tips make this planning easier on you, with a complete strategy for using the techniques inside. If you know what your first and last frost dates are, you'll know when to plant your vegetable crops for year-round harvesting. And at under $20 new from the publisher, it represents a good value. The layout work that the publisher did with the charts, color coding, and index makes sorting through to find what you need simple. There's not a lot of hunting and pecking to find out when exactly something needs to go in the ground, or what vegetable choices she recommends. It's all right there. You have plenty to go off of and can readily adapt what you find in Nikki's book using the principles of permaculture. And one other thing that I like about this is that it comes from Nikki's experience. She's out there doing this. So in the pictures, you get to see her with her garden, working in it year-round, including in the snow. And I'm thankful for that practical experience. So whether you're new to permaculture and gardening, or find that what you're doing doesn't work, or just want a different voice on how to tackle your garden, and your annual crops in particular, this book is worth picking up. As Kirsten mentioned in our interview together, farmers are considered new or beginning for their first 10 years working the land, and I think it's fair for gardeners to consider themselves new at it for at least that time. And as we gain more experience, there's still an imperative for lifelong learning and adaptation. If you'd like to enter into the drawing for a copy of the book, please email contest, C-O-N-T-E-S-T, at thepermaculturepodcast.com with the subject Nikki, N-I-K-I. That'll help me sort through the entries as there will be several contests running concurrently. I'll leave the entries for this drawing open until August 16th, 2013, when I will randomly select and notify the winner, with the book then being sent directly to the winner from the publisher. In the meantime, if you have thoughts or questions after listening to this show or any of the others in the archive, feel free to reach me by email, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or give me a call, 717-827-6266. You can also send me a message on the Facebook page for the show, facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast, or on Twitter, where I am @permaculturecst. Coming up next week, on July 23rd, is Arthur Haynes to discuss wild foods and foraging. On July 30th, to close out this month, is Larry Korn, who joins me to talk about his work with Masanobu Fukuoka and translating the One Straw Revolution for wider audiences. And then we also discuss the philosophy of natural farming and how that or the ideas of permaculture can be used for personal development. That's quite a show. And that brings this episode to a close. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other. And the little bit of legal. The Permaculture Podcast is released under Creative Commons, Attribution, No Derivatives, Non-Commercial License. Please feel free to share it. Just tell people where you got it from, and don't change or sell it.